This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2. The Big Picture, a Christian insight into the world of movies, television and pop culture with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley. A Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's word into every corner of your world.
How are you? I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm his mate who didn't have anywhere to be, Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 131 of The Big Picture for the week beginning October 30. And coming up on today's show, will new Aussie comedy drama Three Summers be the folk music version of The Castle?
X-Men star Michael Fassbender is starring in a chilly serial killer thriller, The Snowman.
Plus George Clooney, Matt Damon and Suburban Mayhem in Suburbicon.
G'day Mark, how's stuff?
Oh, stuff is great, mate.
And is actually, it? We start all our shows by giving a quick snapshot, an overview of what's going on the big screen and the small screen. On the big screen that opened last week, two words, Thor Ragnarok. One word, rocks. Duh, man, that film is so great. Chris Hemsworth, again, is playing the Norse god who's trying to save his home planet. We talked about it on the show last week. My goodness, did we bang on about that movie. Go to thebigpicturewebsite.com for the full review or find the podcast wherever you get good podcasts from. Mark, coming up at cinemas this Thursday are two movies that, this is more of a public service announcement, a warning, if you will, rather than I think people are going to be rushing out to see these. Firstly, a sequel called Bad Mums 2. Bad Mums came out, I think, only last year.
I know.
It didn't really, like, I didn't think it seemed to make much noise at all.
It was meh, and this is meh too.
Yeah, but they didn't go with that catchy title. But it seemed to go okay at box offices around the world, which is why Bad Mums 2, A Bad Mums Christmas, is coming out earlier than Christmas at cinemas. I kid you not, Bad Mums Christmas. Also, Jigsaw, which is a return of the vicious and gruesome killer from those Saw movies. You know, yeah,
they said that they pretty much finished that franchise, but I think somebody needs what?
That's right.
Extension?
So some reason the return of quote-unquote torture porn has come back. Jigsaw, it might even be rated R, I think. So I'm just letting you know that is at cinemas this Thursday along with Bad Mums 2.
More so you can avoid both of them. Yeah. Okay, listen, while you're avoiding the cinemas, go to the TV set. You'll find some really, really good things. Okay,
Such as?
Well, the first is that the ABC has begun airing Victoria. Now, I don't know if you've heard about this TV series, but it's basically a television series about the reign of Queen Victoria, okay? The great-grandmother of Queen Elizabeth II.
Yeah, yeah. Very recently played by Dame Judi Dench in Victoria and Abdul at cinemas.
Indeed. And this time, the young Victoria is being played by Jenna Coleman, who would you know, this feisty actress from Doctor Who fame, is now the feisty monarch.
Well, you would, because you love Doctor Who.
Listen,
and
mate.
Me not so much, but sure, Jenna Coleman from Doctor Who.
So she's there. It's brilliant TV series. It's actually, look, if you don't wait around for the, if you're not keen to rush out on the ABC, it's also going to be coming to Netflix soon. So both season one, season two is actually airing over in the UK at the moment. Brilliant TV. Go watch that if you like period drama. Also, mentioning Netflix, new to Netflix, began 3 days ago, Stranger Things Season 2.
Loads of people are pumped.
Yes, this highly anticipated second season of the first fictional series set in the town of Hawkins in Indiana in the 1980s promises to be just as thrilling as the first. Now, in the first season, if you don't know, it was about a bunch of boys who go on a hunt for a missing girl in the town who is first a missing friend, and then they meet up with a psychokinetic girl who helps them find their missing friend.
Things get weird.
It's very much like kind of The Goonies, but as an adult TV series. It's great fun, good thrilling stuff. The second season picks up 1 year after, so we're not dumping the storyline like Fargo or anything like that. It's right in there, the same town, same guys. Tune in.
Now, Mark, before we get to our first review for this week, this new Australian film called Three Summers, just wanted to do a quick pointer to also something else that's coming up soon. Now, usually around this time in the show, we love to try to stump each other with a true or false statement, a conundrum, if you will. This week, though, we're doing a bit of a spin-off. It's like a spin-off series to True or False. We're going to come up with Whose Line Is It Anyway? So that's coming real soon. But first, we're going to get to this, which is, how do you like your Australian comedies? A bit quirky, like Muriel's Wedding, a bit kitsch, like Strictly Ballroom, or maybe a bit out there, like Priscilla, Queen of the Desert? Well, you might be in luck, because a new Australian comedy by British comedy writer Ben Elton, you know, of Blackadder fame, is set to hit the cinemas this week. Three Summers is about the queer characters who attend a Western Australian folk music festival, Westival, see what they did there?
Clever.
Westival, and the love story between a violinist and a New Age musician that takes place there. Mark headed off to see if Three Summers measured up to Australia's outrageous sense of humour and ended up getting more than he bargained for.
a great little festival.
It's too safe. They book dinosaur pub rock bands.
I'm a 26-year-old folk chick, lucky enough to get paid for it.
I'm not going to pretend that pub rock is my scene.
It is not pub rock. It's folk rock.
Folk rock is pub rock.
The punters love it.
Punters loved Hitler.
Wow. I just wanted to go inside and get a drink of water so I don't dehydrate when I'm there.
Do not make me take you down.
So basically, Three Summers is set in a fictional Western Australian festival called Westival.
Westival.
Magda Zabanski is the chief organiser. She's just one of many, many Australian comedians in it. It's a camping holiday, but with folk music. What's not to love?
I like folk music and camping.
Seriously, the combination. Anyway.
I like folk music and
it's
camping.
It's a lineup that stretches from pub-style Irish music bands to drumming pirates and Morris dancers. And over 3 years, basically see the festival develop and the characters in the festival develop, particularly Kiwi, who's played by Rebecca Breeds, and Roland, played by Robert Sheehan. And the two of them are like poles apart. Kiwi's in a folk Irish band. She plays the violin. Roland plays this weird... He's a part-time musician, plays this weird, bizarre instrument known as the theremin.
Oh, theremins are cool, man.
Yes.
The Beach Boys use one of those.
No, they don't. That's the whole point. He makes that line about... That joke is made about five times
during... I really thought they did. Anyway, back to the movie.
So anyway... The antithesis of these two sets up the tension, lovers. Yeah. Will the Irish girl and the city lad make a beautiful music together? That's your
polar
story.
Polar opposites, yeah. Look, it's not sounding like much to me, that apart from I like folk music and going camping, but where does Three Summers then sit in this, like, the grand scheme of quirky Australian comedies?
Look, I think they really aimed for The Dish. Okay, so, Working Dog, sort of story about a town that, has all its quirks and such, so to speak, or Strictly Ballroom, a culture that had its own sort of quirkiness.
So it's aiming for that.
It's just not that memorable. Like, it really is a bit of a loss because it's sort of... I think it suffers from a scattergun approach. It tries to do 10 or 20 different little mini characters and nothing really sort of digs in and nothing is explored long enough to actually feel like you're getting to really appreciate the quirks. They're just one weird thing after another happens on the screen. Drumming pirates.
With so many characters up on screen, are those characters meant to be representing things or are they just like trying to be quirky characters or are they standing in for something?
Yeah, they're not really standing in for... any particular social groups. They've got a smattering of Australia. In fact, they deliberately push on to sort of try and fill out various social issues throughout the film. And that's, I think, is one of my biggest issues with the film, is that it just basically loads it down with social statements. This is, first and foremost, somebody just should have written a big banner saying, remember, people, were making a comedy, okay? Because Three Summers is pitched as a comedy, and yet it is absolutely overloaded with social issues. Ben Elton has gone crazy. Let me give you a sample.
Please.
It talks about Aboriginal land rights. There are no problems with any of these things, but then it throws in constitutional reform, British child migration, alcoholism in families, illegal immigration, app-related sex. It's just, it goes on and on and on. You cannot point at a social issue that it doesn't try and say something significant about.
So then, does it try to wrap all those things together, though? Is Three Summers trying to, like, does sound like there's way too many things going on, but does it actually try to bring them all together?
Oh, look, they just swamp each other, and they swamp the jokes at the same time. That's the real tragedy. They've got so many really good actors in this. They've got Deborah Malman and John Waters and Michael Caton and Peter Rosethorn. There's just anybody from Australia. As I said, Magda Zabanski. They all get about half a line each. In a quarter of a character for less than 0.1% of screen time. Personally, if there's something they're trying to do, is that they try and wrap it up with this philosophy at the end that we've got to be aware of others' stories. You can't really understand your story until you understand other people's stories.
That sounds good.
Yeah, think about that. You can't really understand your story until you understand other people's stories.
What does that actually mean? It does sound good.
Yeah, it's what you call a sophism, okay?
What?
It's my job to educate, right? Sophism is where it's something that sounds intelligent, but the more you listen to it, the more you realize it's saying nothing. And that is probably the biggest summary of Three Summers that I could give you. Sounds intelligent, but in the end, It's not saying anything.
That's why someone called me a sophism the other day. Three Summers is rated M for coarse language. It stars heaps of Aussie talent, as Mark just mentioned. Everyone from Deborah Mailman right through to Michael Caton. And as Mark just explained, they are totally underutilized. But you can make up your own mind when it opens in cinemas this Thursday. Right, we are going to get into, for the first time ever on The Big Picture, Whose Line Is It Anyway? I'm about to load up real quick five great Aussie film quotes, and I want to know which films they come from. There's going to be no mucking around. This is dinky die, fair dinkum stuff, Mark. I'm just going to say these lines, and you've got to tell me which film they come from. Okay.
Okay, here I go.
Number one, tell him he's dreaming.
The Castle.
Thank you very much. Stated by Daryl Kerrigan. Number two, look, a beginner has no right to approach an open amateur.
Oh, a Strictly Ballroom?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think I had you at open amateur.
Yeah.
How about number three? Tanya, I'd rather swallow razor blades than have a drink with you.
Muriel's Wedding.
Mate, you do know your Aussie movies, particularly lines stated by Rhonda in Muriel's Wedding. Okay, number four. I think this one's going to be a little bit tougher. What we see and what we seem are but a dream. A dream within a dream.
Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Mate.
No? Oh.
Struth, mate. Oath and all that. No, come on. That's from Picnic at Hanging Rock, of course.
I thought we were going on Australian comedy.
So did I, but our producer has jumped in. Our producer has chucked in a curveball, Picnic at Hanging Rock, which I repeat is not an Australian comedy, but in a fantastic Australian drama.
Not exactly
okay.
Laughable.
Number five. Back at... Well, this does have comedy elements. Come what may, I will love you until my dying day.
Oh, okay. Well, that's Moulin Rouge.
Which did have comedy elements. Mark,
that wasn't set in Australia,
you
but
did,
at least
you
it was
did
made.
But it was made entirely by an Australian cast and crew. I won't go into details. That fits under Aussie films. That was Whose Line Was Anyway. Mark did very, very well. Still to come on the show, X-Men star Michael Fassbender in a chilly serial killer thriller, The Snowman, and George Clooney, Matt Damon, and the Coen brothers go to the dark side of the suburbs. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us on The Big Picture. If you've missed any of The Big Picture from our back catalogue of editions, go to the place where you find great podcasts, and you'll find all of The Big Picture's past episodes. Enjoy.
Or go see thebigpicturewebsite.com.
Do it.
Great place to see. Okay, well, look, last break we dragged you through Three Summers, a comedy that won't last anywhere near as long. But for our soundtrack segment, we thought we'd bring back to mind a fun film that is actually full of laughs and thinking. The Big Sick releases on Blu-ray and DVD this week. What better way to remember it than by its soundtrack? Here's Vance Joy with Mess Is Mine.
Always me and you, shaping up and shipping out. Check me in and check me out. Do you like walking in the rain? When you think of love, do you think of pain? You can tell me what you see. I will choose what I believe. Hold on, darling. This body is yours, this body is yours and mine. Well, hold on, my darling. This mess was yours, now your mess is mine. Walking round at 8 a.m. Got 2 hours before my flight. Luck be on my side tonight. You're the reason that I feel so strong. The reason that I'm hanging on. You know you gave me all the time. Well, did I give? This body is yours, this body is yours and mine. Well, hold on.
If you like soundtracks, stay tuned because we have a film and TV composer joining us later in the show to talk about the tricks of the trade.
That's coming up real soon.
It's actually a good time to be stocking up on rocking films with rocking soundtracks. The Big Sick, as we said, is released November 1st. So too is Baby Driver. Both had notable soundtracks. And, of course, Diary of a Wimpy Kid,
Who
the Long Haul.
Who doesn't remember Diary of a Wimpy Kid, the Long Haul soundtrack, Mark?
Is, as everyone knows, there's that very annoying scene when the entire family sings the Spice Girls' Wannabe. Absolutely unforgettable. I know because I've had the counselling. Detectives on the trail of serial killers are about as common at cinemas and smaller screens as getting the flu during winter. The Snowman is the latest big screen crack at the serial killer thriller, and it stars Michael Fassbender, Rebecca Ferguson, and a bunch of other strong talent. Ben rugged up and braced himself for The Snowman, which turned out to be more of a slushy mess than an icy chiller.
Another missing woman.
There's something we're not seeing.
What matters most is that we celebrate the way this has brought us together.
Anyone can see that he's trying to hide something.
You can't force the pieces to fit.
You could have saved them.
No.
Gave you all the clues.
It gave you all the clues.
Oh, no.
That was...
Why didn't we see it coming?
Why didn't we see it coming? I wished I'd seen this coming and just avoided it like the plague. Right, so the storyline, put simply, is The Snowman is based on a novel by a Norwegian author called Jo Nesbø. It's the seventh in a series of novels about this detective called Harry Hole that Michael Fassbender is playing. In the seventh novel in the series, The Snowman, he comes to be on the case of a serial killer who is mutilating women's bodies, and it doesn't seem to be exactly clear how they're linked, but they are. They do seem to be linked because of the way they're either treating their children or their partner. That seems to be the thread. The film's set in Norway. And Harry Hole, who's a drunk detective, basically trying to solve the case, while some other threads are going on around it, Mark, including Oslo trying to make a bid for the Winter World Cup and another...
Mate, you sound uncertain about this.
Oh, there are so many things I am uncertain about. What I'm not uncertain about is The Snowman is a massive mess. It itself is a movie that is uncertain about itself.
Mm, oh, gosh. Okay. So this sounds like a whole lot of films that we've had before, you know, Kiss the Girls or Silence of the Lambs. There's always some serial killer out there we've got to track down. Is there anything that really makes it stand out?
As I may have already been intimating, Mark, what makes it stand out is that it's a mess of missed opportunities and talent. And I haven't read the novel. The mate I went to went to see the film has read the novel, and he was explaining to me the novel afterwards and elements of it. And I won't bore you with the details of it, but it actually didn't sound boring, which the movie was. It sounded very intriguing. And what seems to have happened here is to get it onto screen, it's an adaptation that seems to the thinking behind it is how can we simplify the story like as much as we possibly can, to the point where as a viewer who has no idea about this character or like what's going on, it's puzzling to work out everything from Harry Hole, this lead character, why is he a drunk? Why has he got such a reputation? Everyone he meets goes, oh, Harry Hole, you serve all these cases. But
we're jumping in seven books later.
That's right. But yeah. In the film, you don't even get a sense of that. He just seems to be a bit bumbling and useless. And sure, he's got an okay like technique of interviewing people. But that's it. Like, what? And he doesn't even seem to know how he's going to solve this particular case. So everything from that to the... This is a movie where I think even people who don't claim that they know much about movies will notice stuff like editing. You don't normally come out of a movie and say, oh, the editing. But there are some jumps in this film that make it feel like you can tell. If you go and read about the director of this, Thomas Alfredson, who made this film, he's actually admitted that the production of this was rushed, that when they got into the editing suite, they felt like, oh, we've only got about 80% of our movie. We're going to have to cobble it together. It's like a jigsaw puzzle with missing pieces. It feels like that. And so some of the editing, you jump from scene to scene, there's no explanation. You don't understand who these characters are. You don't really understand what the plot's about. You don't understand the motivation of killers, et cetera, et cetera. And it's fairly boring.
Oh, gosh. Okay, so The Snowman, no. But this whole genre, like the killer thrillers, are you a bit of a fan of that?
Look, I do quite like them. And this one, so it's set in Norway. And the last couple of years, there's been some big TV dramas coming out of Scandinavia that tend to revolve around these kind of storylines, really sophisticated, complex killing sprees and detectives trying to sort them out, like The Bridge is a famous example. I really like those. As I watched that and as I was watching The Snowman, because I had plenty of time on my hands, Mark, to actually think about other things apart from how much of a mess this movie is, what I'm thinking about is, why am I entertained?
Doing your taxes.
Oh, mate, I was just trying to look anywhere else. It is such a waste of talent. But as I'm plodding through this movie, I'm thinking, why am I even entertained by this kind of story? It's some moments are really graphic, and even why the killer is mutilating these bodies doesn't make any sense at the end. But as I'm trying to puzzle that out, I just was questioning myself a little bit about, why am I entertained by this? Loads of us as viewers are, and I had enough time to think in The Snowman and challenge myself, why am I entertained? I think on one level, it's because of the sophistication and the cat and mouse game. At some other levels, though, I think it's the plunging into the dark heart of humanity, which I'm quite enticed by, but I think I've got to check myself on that little bit of how much I actually enjoy it.
Well, you were talking about the dark heart of humanity, and a little earlier you were saying this had a lot to do with parents and children and the way people were treating each other. There's some dark undercurrents there.
Yeah.
Can viewers take anything significant from that aspect? Is there anything about that?
Look, and again, The Snowman itself doesn't offer this. You've really got to walk away and think about it yourself. But there's a lot of plot threads going on in here about relationship between parents and kids, particularly between fathers and children or mothers and children. And look, what The Snowman and plenty of other movies can represent, The Snowman does it in a bad way, but what it does point to some degree with this undercurrent going through it is just how much of a mess we can make of relationships and how badly people can treat each other, particularly those that you're meant to love the most, and especially those that are meant to be in a right and true and loving and protective relationship. So hopefully watching The Snowman like would drive you back to trying to work out how you, whoever you are as a person, could better relate to those around you and not go off in any kind of track that The Snowman is trying to cover.
Like killing them.
Like killing them. Like back up from that. But even like way, way, way before that, it might actually drive you to think about just how dark and unsettled and wrong our relationships can be. And maybe you might want to, you know, go back towards a more positive version of the relationships we're with our nearest and dearest. But The Snowman, mate, I've got to stop because we'll spend the rest of the time talking of examples of how this thing was a mess. Just in short, it was a mess. Don't go see it.
Oh, gosh. Okay, well, if you were, in fact, interested by that, The Snowman stars Michael Fassbender, Val Kilmer, and Rebecca Ferguson. It's rated MA-15+ for strong themes and violence. No big surprise there. And is now showing at a dry, unslushy cinema near you.
Next up on The Big Picture, we're going to speak with a movie and TV composer about putting sound to the screen before Mark investigates what George Clooney, Matt Damon, and the Coen brothers are doing to suburbia.
Welcome back.
It's actually been quite a musical show so far. We've got all folksy with music festival film Three Summers, hit the musical highlights from The Big Sick, and coming up next, the latest offbeat comedy from Hollywood writers, the Coen brothers, who were legendary for their use of music in film. So we thought, why not to go into that review a little bit better informed. This week, for our press record segment, we sent Mark off to speak to Dave, a man who makes part of his living composing those moving musical backdrops for film and TV.
Dave, thanks very much for joining us. Look, it's a fascinating thing for me. We run an entire segment every week on soundtracks and how they undergird productions and things. Now, you've composed music for soundtracks before. What's the first thing you try and understand about a production before you get to work?
The first port of information gathering, if you like, is around themes and ideas. So I sort of talk to directors and producers and say, what are the ideas you're trying to communicate? There may be sections that are specific towards love or towards celebration, and those kind of things then give you a framework for shaping your musical ideas. I've been asked in the past to do pieces around different cultures, and so then there's an element of learning scales and chord progressions and things that are, as an average white guy, not really common to my musical library. So those kind of things are important to know up front. And then it's really just shaping those ideas and themes around the specific content that's presented to you in the finished visuals.
So you find yourself dealing often with broad emotions, is that the idea, or broad feelings they want to convey?
Yeah, take an ordinary film and you will have a whole range of different scenarios where it may be a character theme, where the character is a longing character, is a driven or a searching kind of character, and you want your music to help communicate that. There's certain ideas that can tell that story better than others. I mean, if you have a boom, ba, boom, ba, boom, ba, plodding along kind of sound, that's going to give a certain response to the visuals that would be different to, say, a string, you know, really intricate melody.
I guess there's a lot of instruments involved. Now, John Williams, you know, the composer of E.T. and so many other sort of soundtracks, once said that if he wanted to convey nobility, he'd be using French horns. That's what he always reached for that particular thing. Do you have particular go-to instruments for go-to feelings or things like that?
Yeah, definitely. Look, on John Williams, getting back to the themes, he is the master. I mean, if you look at just Star Wars alone, he has a theme for each character, a theme for love, a theme for distance, and all of those intertwine. I mean, when as horrible as the first three movies are, when you look at the theme for Anakin Skywalker, it's a beautiful piece with some innocence in it, with some sadness, with some triumph, and then it finishes with just a little ba bum bum ba, like just a hint of the Imperial March of who Anakin is to come, and that. Like, I get goosebumps thinking about how clever that is just to intertwine all of that together. So, and on the Imperial March, I mean, that's a very sinister use of his nobility French horns there. Like, I mean, they're incredible in that piece. So, yeah, I have two go-to things. Strings always tell a story that people can relate to when it comes to sadness. And so a clever use of strings for anything that's sort of kind of sad. But also the oboe. I'm fascinated with the sound of the oboe. The two reeds that create that really interesting resonance through the instrument just really speak to me.
Wow. It sounds like you can convey so many things. Now, I know you're a Christian. Can you convey faith? Can you convey reverence through music?
Look, I definitely think there is a place for that in what we do. But most often, you are bound by the content that you're representing. So you can't clearly communicate your faith when you're doing a TV commercial about trucks. It's tricky. Not through the music anyway. I guess the way you act with your clients, with the rest of the crew, those kind of things communicate a point of difference in your character. But purely when it's work, we are delivering what is required to a level that is expected. Now, I try and go above and beyond, and I try and utilize my gifts the way that I believe they've been designed to be used. But primarily, I'm writing music for the purpose of fulfilling a brief. Certainly during that process, there's times where I go, wow, this is amazing. This is not really coming from inside me. This is inspired. Without blowing my own French horn. but certainly I guess the aspects of faith come into the process outside of the actual writing music.
The Coen brothers, the legendary Hollywood writers who gave us No Country for Old Men, True Grit, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and Fargo, just to name a few, are back with a brand new comedy, this time directed and co-written by George Clooney. Suburbicon is the story of a home invasion in a quiet town and how it manages to transform the life of a simple bank employee, played by Matt Damon. But Ethan and Joel are a bit of an unknown quantity. Even with such great titles to their names, they also brought us Hail Caesar, Burn After Reading, and The Big Lebowski.
Hang on a second, champ. Are you trying to somehow say subtly that The Big Lebowski is a bit of a dud?
There's nothing subtle about it. It's junk. But that's it. Oh. This is why we thought that rather than entrust the review of Suburbicon to just one of us, we'd better head off together to the preview and file our report from Suburbicon there.
So, Mark, we've just walked out of Suburbicon, just sitting outside the doors of the cinema. So what's your verdict?
I think I'm as stunned as you are.
I am looking a bit stunned, am I not? And I feel stunned.
Yeah, yeah. It's look, for those people who are going to be investigating this as a story, basically you have the story of Matt Damon's character as a bank manager or financial sort of type who involves himself in a nefarious deal. And we don't want to go too much into it, just give the plot away. But it's a very typical Coen Brothers arc with the idea that somebody takes a step across the line and then it all starts to fall apart, you know, piece by piece. But this one, what did you think? Do you think this one has fallen apart in a way that I've never seen a Coen Brothers film do?
Yeah, I actually think it crossed the line more than some other Coen Brothers projects do. And we should keep reiterating, George Clooney co-wrote this and also directed it. So it's not a Coen Brothers movie, but it feels very Coen Brothers all the way through. Apart from, like you're saying, it all seems to fall apart. It's not nowhere near as strong as you expect, not as cohesive, not hanging together as you expect. I think the biggest issue with the film, and why I think it crosses the line, two biggest issues. One is the characters aren't funny or interesting enough. And the other one is it puts a boy in the middle of such danger that for the first time that I can think of out of all the Coen Brothers movies, it is so dark, yet not funny, yet not really redeemable or quirky or anything, that I just felt awkward and icky for most of the movie.
Yeah, that's true. So for people who will be watching this and thinking to themselves, well, would I take somebody to see a Coen Brothers film? Is it okay? I would take someone who is resilient, but I'd be very careful. I mean, what Ben's referring to is the fact that one of the key characters is a young boy who has so much terror placed on him in this film that it's almost a horror film. Like, it's all, that some of the things that are going on there are decidedly really scary. And this is just, and even though it follows the normal trajectory of a Coen Brothers film, that all the bad guys get theirs in the end, whether they're respectable bad guys or crime bad guys.
That's not even giving too much away with a Coen Brothers project. Pretty much if you've seen one, you know what's going to happen to most people in the film, particularly if they're not nice people. So it's not nearly as funny. Even when it's dark funny and that questionable sense of humour funny that Coen Brothers can have, it definitely didn't have that. But it also didn't have interesting characters or even an interesting hook. Like, what's the message of Suburbicon? What is it telling me? I think even Fargo dares to dive into the dark heart of people and let you reflect on the choices, the bad choices people can make and the consequences of them. I don't think Suburbicon was about that. Do you?
I think a lot of it is in the title. Okay, so I guess we're segueing now onto the spiritual content of the film. And Suburbicon is supposed to be an ideal town, but it's actually Suburbia Icon, you know, when they're put together. So there's obviously some sense of idolatry that's been made of the American suburbs. And as we delve into this town, we realise that there's two storylines running along. One is the great sort of mystery with Matt Damon and his family.
Which isn't even much of a mystery, let's be honest. Like, it's pretty clear what's going on early on. And I'm not even one of those guys who picks the mystery, but come on, it wasn't that great. Anyway, sorry, that's going on, Matt Damon and his family.
Yeah, and then there's this black family that's moved into the town, and they're basically being terrorised by all the white people. And so you get to a point in the film where it becomes clear that we are all animals underneath the surface. That, you know, given the right circumstances, people will do really terrible things, which, by the way, I think is really straight out of, you know, Genesis to Revelation. The idea that given the right circumstances, we could all be guilty of the worst sins. And here we are in suburbia uncovering that in a sort of ideal 1950s environment.
One of the worst sins, I think, for me of Suburbicon was that central contrast between the African-American family that's moved in kind of next door to Matt Damon's family and the way they're being treated versus the way Matt Damon is being entirely left alone because he's white and suburban and people just expect he's doing the right thing. Excellent idea. I thought totally wasted in this movie. So wrapping all this together, Mark, it sounds like both of us aren't fans of Suburbicon. Is there any reason you'd be recommending this to anyone?
Yeah, I think I would point people to this film to say, hey, the Coen brothers are really capable of doing great things. This is not one of them, but you should go and look at some of the things the Coen brothers have done. Maybe give Suburbicon a miss.
Turns out we totally agree. Suburbicon is directed by George Clooney. It stars Matt Damon, Oscar Isaac, and Julianne Moore. It's rated MA15+ for strong themes and violence, and it opened last Thursday at cinemas October 26.
And still to come, three reasons why the Coen brothers are a big deal, and Ben's top five films that make him want to live in suburbia. You will too.
Hey, welcome back. Thanks for joining us. Coming up very soon, we're going to be hitting the top five for this week. But before that, this.
Ever been discussing films or TV with your mates and they go on about some director or actor you know you're meant to know? Ben McKeggan.
I don't actually
know why these people are such a big deal. Well, the Coen brothers can be like that. You might have just heard about them for the first time in our last segment, the writer-director siblings Ethan and Joel Coen. And if you haven't heard about them even yet, you know, check out our podcast. That's a good thing to do. But you're a bit puzzled as to why they have such a giant reputation. Well, for The Vault this week, freelance movie commentator for Empire Magazine, SBS and News Limited, Jim Mitchell, shares with us the three reasons why the Coen brothers are a big deal. G'day, Jim.
G'day, Jim.
G'day, guys.
Hey, mate, are you a guy who likes to bang on in conversations about really important people in movies and TV, even if other people don't know who you're talking about?
Yes, try and stop me.
We are not going to try and stop you, Jim. Instead, we've brought you on the show because we do want to know the three quick reasons why the Coen brothers are a big deal. Give us number one.
Okay, well, if you look at their back catalogue, I mean, it's amazing amount of movies they've done. And they've got this mix of mainstream and also art house films. So
that's a pretty unique blend, isn't it? Mainstream and art house. Few directors have been able to manage that.
Absolutely. And these guys are writing, directing, producing it. And they can really switch from genres really effortlessly. So if you look at, like, the gangster pick Miller's Crossing, which is one of my favourite of that
fantastic
genre,
film.
They did, yeah, the remake of True Grit. They did, I mean, they do noir so well. They did Fargo, No Country for Old Men. They've done romance, Intolerable Cruelty, sort of screwball comedies like Hail Caesar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's not forget Raising Arizona.
And Hudsucker Proxy.
I know. It's all over the place.
They are big deals, it turns out, the Coen brothers. Okay, so they straddle mainstream and art house, Jim. What's your second reason?
Well, some of their movies are, let's say, very eclectic and kind of very weird, but...
You could say that, Jim, yes.
Yeah. I mean, they've had some big names, and I think it's because these guys, the writing, the characters, their artistry is just superlative. George Clooney has been a major collaborator. He's been in about four movies. I haven't seen him have as much fun for a long time in a movie as I did in Hail Caesar.
Mm-hmm.
And he starred with Brad Pitt in Burn After Reading, and then there was Tom Hanks in The Lady Killers.
Mm, they get really big names, don't they?
Oh, absolutely, and they keep coming back as well. You know, you think of Jeff Bridges, who's just so unforgettable as a character called the Dude in the Big Lebowski, and Julianne Moore was in that, and
Jeff Bridges returns for True Grit.
You know, So just the list goes on.
Okay, so they straddle mainstream and art house. They attract big, 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 big names. Third reason?
Okay, the quirk. I mean...
the quirk.
The quirk factor, which I believe is something that's actually measured on a quirkometer.
Quirkometer. Yeah, on the quirkometer, Jim, where do they rate?
12. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, these guys, I think, are the best around at doing that type of thing. You know, they create these kind of darkly funny, you know, sometimes quite malevolent kind of atmospheres. But, yeah, full of quirk. And I think the main reason for that, you know, the writing and the characters are just so richly textured. And they're just so idiosyncratic. And you really... You come out of a movie really remembering these characters, and I think you know that's a major thing. And they've won some, you know, and been nominated for some Oscars for their quirky talents. Most notably winning Best Picture for No Country for Old Men.
Yeah, mate, that on an Oscar-worthy note, that's a great note to end on. Jim Mitchell, thank you very much for joining us on The Big Picture for the three reasons why the Coen brothers are a big deal.
Thanks.
Okie dokie, Mark, we are at the finale of the show.
We like to refer to it as the audio pinnacle. of The Big Picture. We come to the top five each week. And in fact, actually, I would just like to say that I'm particularly looking forward to this top five because Ben McKechnie is something of a city boy. I don't want to say a city mama's boy. I'm just saying he lives...
No, you don't want to say that. No.
He lives in the inner city. He delves into art house cinema. He knows where the best coffee can be found. He will wear T-shirts that look like they were old when they were made. You know, is that sort of person? So he's going to give us this week, since we've been talking about Suburbicon, his top five films that make him want to live in suburbia. Is it possible for him to convince citygoers to move to the suburbs? Let's see.
Five.
That's right, Mark. The top five movies that make me want to move to suburbia from my inner city dwelling pad lifestyle thing. At number five, Lantana, that Australian film from 2001.
Yikes. Why would you say move to the suburbs?
Here's the thing, Mark. Okay. Yeah, follow me. Follow me on this. I imagine that your response to my saying Lantana is because Lantana is full of all kinds of depressing stuff.
Yeah, lives falling apart.
That's
in
right.
The suburbs.
That's right. It's a movie set in suburbia, as you just said. But there are plenty of relationships crumbling, particularly around affairs and marital dysfunction.
You just want something interesting to look at over the fence.
That's getting to my reason. There's always a silver lining, Mark. And the silver lining when I watch Lantana is that, wow, people have houses in Australia, like actual houses. I live in a unit. I have a communal backyard that I use when I take my children out, you know, to play outside. We tend to go to a park. But when I watch Lantana, people have backyards and front yards, Mark, that they get to play in and lounge in, and they get to choose, they get to pick and choose, they even have a driveway.
You'd like some real estate.
I have to park my car on the street. Okay. That is appealing to me, and why Lantana is at number five.
Four.
Okay, now we are going to shift to the other side of the world, because I really struggled to find many films about Australian suburbia that, as we just noted with Lantana, weren't dark and bleak and depressing. And so in terms of reasons for making me want to go to suburbia, Australia doesn't have a lot to offer up on screen, but America does. 1973's American Graffiti. If you haven't seen this film, go and find it. You can definitely get it on iTunes. This was directed by George Lucas before he was George Lucas, before Star Wars erupted. Ron Howard, Star Wars, Harrison Ford was in it. Richard Dreyfuss, this great kind of 70s Brat Pack cast. It's like Happy Days, but for more mature viewers. And it's set on the last summer's night before college in suburban America. The reason it makes me want to move to suburbia, Mark, is apparently in suburbia, at least in America, you get to hang out all night with your friends and eat burgers and drive around and listen to rock and roll music and eat burgers.
Don't forget the leather jackets.
And the leather jackets. And you get to hang out with not only Ron Howard, like from Happy Days, but you get to hang out with Han Solo as well.
That happens every Friday night at my house.
In your suburban pad.
Yeah, we just hang out with Ron, put our leather jackets on.
Why don't you invite me?
Well, because you live in the city. It's so far to commute.
998's The Truman Show. Now, hear me out on this one too.
Because if you live in the suburbs, you'll be mind controlled by some.
I do not, for the record, think that the suburbs of Australia, let alone the rest of the world, are like The Truman Show exactly. Where The Truman Show, if you haven't seen it, it's an incredible film starring Jim Carrey. Ed Harris is in it, directed by Australia's Peter Weir, about this manufactured suburban existence that's got this kind of cookie cutter feel where every house is the same. Everyone's like super nice all the time, relentlessly. I don't think suburbia is like that, right? And I particularly don't think about it as the mind control issue the further you get into Truman Show and work out what's actually going on.
One or two suburbs, but not all of them.
But no. The silver lining, a little bit like Lantana, is that, wow, in suburbia, everyone knows you. Isn't that cool?
Yep.
Everyone's so friendly and warm and welcoming. People say hello.
Just so long as you don't put your bins on the front of their verge.
Well, that was never depicted in Truman Show. I want to move to that kind of suburbia. Whereas, you know, like when I'm hustling to get to the train station, I just plow through. Even if older ladies are getting in my way, I barge through. I'm not polite. I'm usually a really polite dude.
But you don't say good afternoon, good evening, good night.
I do not say good afternoon, good evening, or good night like the Truman Show. But that's why I want to move to suburbia, because I think I would if I lived there. 1990s Edward Scissorhands.
this is the attraction of the suburbs.
Yeah, look at it.
There are people out there with scissors for hands.
All of these amazing movies about suburbia that just make me want to live there, including the place in the world where Tim Burton's Edward Scissorhands exists, not just because there's a guy who's got scissors for hands played by Johnny Depp, but because, a little bit like how helpful The Truman Show seems to be and what Lantana offers, this kind of space and freedom, in Edward Scissorhands, you get a place not only where a guy can help shape your hedges and make them look really good, but you can find a place for everyone to fit in, apparently, in suburbia. Haven't you found that in your suburban life?
There is. My street alone contains every sort of person, not all of them. Anyway, we'll move on.
But apparently, that's what suburbia is selling to me, is that if I feel a little bit out of place, a little bit like I can't find a home, I can just go to where Edward Scissorhands hangs out, and no matter who I am, I can get a place there. 1999's American Beauty.
Again, you want to go to suburbia to watch family disintegration.
That's right. Like Lantana, American Beauty, that Oscar-winning adult drama about midlife crisis, is exactly about that midlife crisis and people's lives falling apart, largely depicted by this character that Kevin Spacey plays, who flips out in midlife, gets infatuated with his daughter's friend, his wife Annette Bening's drifting off, etc., etc. Everyone's so self-absorbed and they're hating on their loved ones. There's parents versus kids and spouses versus spouses. It's terrible. But there are moments of actual beauty to be found in life. So American Beauty, for me at least, affirms this idea that no matter how bad things are, you can take a moment out to discover some actual beauty. And apparently you can do this in the suburbs, like taking a video of a floating plastic bag in the wind, as they depict in American Beauty, and finding something tremendously beautiful and exotic and rich about that. Now, I'm sure in the film it's actually probably meant to be a metaphor for how empty and meaningless life is, but I choose to take it the other way. And I want to stop and look for beautiful moments in life around me, and apparently I can do that in suburbia.
We're having everyone write out a job description. That way management can assess who's valuable
and who's expendable.
My parents are trying to take an active interest in me. Why can't they just have their own lives?
I'm so proud of you. You didn't screw up once.
Oh my God. It says psycho next door.
Jane, what if he worships you?
I didn't mean to scare you. I'm not obsessing. Just curious.
Why does he dress like a Bible salesman?
Today I quit my job, and then I blackmailed my boss for almost $60,000. Pass the asparagus.
And that's just one of the many reasons why one day I might leave my inner city pad and move to suburbia.
Okay, well, coming up next week, more Strange Things on your telly with Stranger Things Season 2.
And the director of The Hurt Locker unveils more pain in Detroit.
Plus, Hollywood royalty go on a train trip in Murder on the Orient Express.
Toot toot, I will be Ben McKechnie next week.
And I'll still be Mark Adley. See you then.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world. Thanks for listening. Start your day with Life Words. Subscribe to Hope 1032's free daily email devotional at hope1032.com.au.